Risa Willis spent decades avoiding her high school reunions, but when the 40th rolled around, she caved and decided it was time to go home again, even though her family farm near Little Sioux is long gone. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. When Willis went home for that reunion, she brought her British husband and a terrific sense of humor. And the result is a collection of memories of growing up in far western Iowa called Farmer's Daughter and I Can Prove It. I'll talk with her. Then later in the hour, we'll remember the life, work, and legacy of Kurt Fries of Iowa City. He was a chef, a restaurateur, publisher, author, activist, and politician. He passed away suddenly last week. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll remember the life and work of Kurt Michael Fries of Iowa City, a man who made a tremendous impact on Iowa's food scene in many ways. He passed away last week. But first, Risa Willis grew up on a farm outside of Little Sioux, Iowa. After leaving for college, she rarely returned, but was lured back home for her 40th high school reunion. That experience led to a delightful collection of memories of growing up on that farm and in that community. It's called Farmer's Daughter and I Can Prove It. Willis is a writer and professor emerita of English at Drury University in Springfield, Missouri. She is with us on the line today. Hello, Risa.
Hi, Charity. Nice to talk with you.
Well, it's lovely to talk with you, too. And tell me a little bit, why were you so reluctant to attend those high school reunions all those years?
Well, I was busy, for one thing, you know, getting my education, and I was also teaching while I was working on my PhD. And also, I think I was just a little reticent to go back and maybe face some what were, at the time, kind of sad memories. My father died way too young. My mother did. And so I didn't leave the farm under happy circumstances. So I just kind of didn't want to think about it for a while.
And
but then, in retrospect, I'm glad I did go back and did think about it.
Yeah. You also had a little bit of family pressure to go back. Your husband is British, and I sense that he just had a tremendous curiosity about high school reunions in the United States.
Oh, he really did. I mean, the high school reunion, or college ones as far as that goes, that's a very American thing. And he never really understood it. Of course, he was living and working in the United States, and he would hear from his fellow workers about going to such and such reunion, and he would ask me about it, and he was just very curious. And so when I finally, you know, agreed to go, he was very happy about it. What we do for love.
Well, you tried to satisfy his curiosity by showing him Romy and Michelle's high school reunion, the movie?
Yes. And he still wanted to go. So.
All right. I suspect that your reunion probably didn't resemble Romy and Michelle's high school reunion all that much. But before we talk about what the reunion was like, let's talk a little bit about your family. You did grow up on a farm outside of Little Sioux, and your family was pretty unusual. You had two older sisters who were a lot older than you, right?
Oh, yeah. My oldest sister was 24 years old, older than me when I came along. In fact, I have a nephew my age. I have a nephew just a few months younger than I am. And then my middle sister, she was 16 years older than me. And, you know, and then I came along. And I often thought my poor mother, she had a rebellious 16-year-old and a new baby.
So tell me a little bit about your parents. You've done the math. You know that your mom became a mother when she was 15 years old, and your dad would have been 19, right?
Yeah, and it's just kind of odd when you're growing up. You don't ever think of your parents in that way. But when I went back and kind of did the math, you know, because I'm a biographer, I would always do that when I would write about a topic, whether it was Mark Twain or Franklin Roosevelt. I would put out, the year they were born, you know, when they went to school, you know, a timeline. And I started to do that with my own parents and my family, my sisters and myself. And I started to see that no matter how I looked at it, my mother would have had to gotten pregnant when she was 14. Wow. And now I wish that there was someone I could ask more about that, or just so many family questions that everyone has. As I say, you know, families keep secrets, some for good, some for ill.
And both of your parents completed school in the eighth grade.
Eighth grade, right.
So education was something that they really believed could lift you and your sisters. And that started really young in your house. I love your stories about your dad teaching you to read before you even went to kindergarten.
Yeah, I could. He taught me to read. He had a little blackboard. And my oldest sister, Edith, she had a teaching degree. And she taught till she got married. That's what you did in those days. And she had the Dick and Jane books, which I think so many Iowans will recognize mm-hmm. as to where they got their start in reading. And so, yeah, he read to me out of those, and I could recite the words and, you know, count and write my name. And, yeah, he was, although not much formal education, he was very, very intelligent. And I think my mother was, too. They both read a lot and had a lot of books. I've had people ask me, you know, from reading the book, my book, they say, well, where did your parents get these books? And, you know, I don't know. And it's a puzzle to me because there weren't bookstores then. And they lived on a farm and never went to towns that had a population greater of about 300 to 1,000. So I've often wondered where they got all those fabulous books that they read.
And you were a voracious reader. You also found your parents' secret stash of the books you weren't supposed to read. Tell me about
That's right. Yeah, no wonder I became an English major. Yes, you know, back to the question of where did they get these books. I mean, they had, you know, like Shakespeare's works, and there were other things like the Peyton Place. That was quite topical in the 50s and 60s. You know, the Tropic of Cancer, some things that probably a young lady shouldn't have been reading.
Well, and those were hidden. Were they hidden under the bed?
Yes, they were hidden under some, I think it was bedding. There was a closet where they kept all the books, and my mother also kept bedding in there. And I think they were hidden under that. And when both parents were, both my parents were out busy, of course, they always worked, you know, I got to snooping around and found those books. And, you know, mothers with mother's intuitions, she suspected something was going on there. And so she replaced them with some, I guess, what she thought would be better material for a young lady.
Like what?
Well, I did get to read the Canterbury Tales, you know. There was some Jane Austen in there, you know. As I said, no wonder I became an English major in English.
Right. Well, and this is great parenting advice from your mother to me. I need to start hiding the books that I really want my kids to read. Make them forbidden fruit.
Absolutely.
So obviously your parents cared a lot about your education and the education of your older sisters as well. Did they talk about that?
Oh, yeah. You know, just it was always, I guess, kind of the underlying message that, you know, no matter what, don't end up on a farm because, as my dad would say, it's just too much hard work. And I think my two older sisters also would repeat at times that, you know, if we'd married a farmer, Dad would have disinherited us.
Well, and you have a new perspective on that farm that you grew up on as well, or at least you came to a new perspective as an adult, because your parents were farming rented land. They didn't own their land, right?
No. Yeah, it was, as I write in my book, it wasn't until I got to college that I realized my dad was really a sharecropper. A very wealthy family owned most of western Iowa, and would routinely visit those farms. And so there were, you know, a good probably maybe 7-8 farms in the area I grew up on where they would come and visit and see how things were going. And of course you got free rent and half the money that you made off the crops. And then my parents supplemented that with sold milk, sold eggs. We had our own cattle. We had hogs. My father raised hogs and sold them. And so I, you know, we weren't wealthy, but I never wanted for anything. But I think, as most parents do, they want better for their children. And so education was always, always stressed.
You know,
just as much as you can.
And did your dad actually say, never marry a farmer? Was that explicit?
Yes. Because it was, you know, nothing about their character, because the characters of farmers, you can't find better people. They're hardworking. You know, they often have to have a great sense of humor. They're respectful of others. They respect the earth. They respect God. But it was just, it was such hard work, and he knew how hard it was, and very capricious. You were so dependent on the weather, you know, just so dependent on so many things.
Right, as you said, farmers in Iowa didn't need to go to Las Vegas. They were gambling every day.
Yes, they were, and farmers still do today. I live presently, well, I have for left almost 50 years, on some acreage here in Missouri, and I have lots of neighbors who are dairy farmers and also farm hay and raise cattle. So I'm still in a farming community. I'm just not doing it for a living.
Which I'm sure would make your dad pleased and proud. Tell me a little bit about school, because, again, you were in a very rural part of Iowa, and as much as we talk about school consolidation now, your family really was involved in that first wave of school consolidation, right?
Yes, yeah. In fact, I ended up going to two different schools. I think I did kindergarten in one, and then there was kind of this consolidation was gradual. And then I went to another school, I believe, up until about that. I may have gone like third grade through eighth. You know, and these schools were not very far apart, just different districts. And then I finished up high school in Mount Damon.
And it also meant that you spent a lot of time on the bus.
Yes, a lot of time on the bus.
Just tell me briefly about your bus driver.
Oh, yeah. I still think about Titch.
Old man Titch, you called him.
Yeah, old man Titch, yes. That's what all the kids called him. And, you know, I think back on it, he probably was 35 or 40. When you're a kid, you know, everybody that's older than you is old man or old woman somebody, you know.
But when he would yell so loud that his false teeth would actually fall out of his mouth?
Yes, they would fly out of his mouth. And so after that, but you have to remember, my goodness, what were the dental arts like in the 50s? They couldn't have been very good, to say the least. They couldn't have been very good. And so, yeah, he would get angry with us because, you know, we were being kids.
Right.
And he would yell at us, and, you know, false teeth would fly out of his mouth. And he finally got so he just didn't wear them at all.
All right, we're going to take a short break. Risa Willis is with me. Her book is Farmer's Daughter and I Can Prove It. She grew up on a farm outside of Little Sioux in western Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest right now is Risa Willis. She grew up on a farm outside of Little Sioux, Iowa, and she recently published a collection of memories of growing up on that farm and going to school. It's called Farmer's Daughter and I Can Prove It. And these memories were prompted by a return home for her 40th high school reunion. And Risa, I would love for you to read a little bit from the book for us. And this is about how farming is feminism. And it's a little bit about what it was like to be a woman on the farm. Farm life is a feminist movement is what you called this chapter.
Yes, and it certainly was. I didn't realize it at the time, but it certainly was. The women worked just as hard, you know, as the men did, often in the fields. You know, my mother drove a tractor, just like my dad, helped him with the farm chores, you know, milking and taking care of the hogs. And she was just very typical of all the women in the area. But since this is fall and harvest time, I was going to read this section from where the women got together to cook for harvest time.
All right.
Harvest. I helped my mother cook and bake for the harvesting crews in the fall. Families in our neighborhood banded together to get everyone's crops in. During these times, the cooking crew of women, neighbors, also circulated from farm to farm, racing the weather. It was an intense couple of weeks of dawn to dark, and sometimes after dark, for farmers to get their crops harvested and stored before the fall rains. It began with breakfast at first light. 8 to 10 husbands, fathers, sons would eat a huge breakfast of eggs, bacon, bread, fried potatoes, and coffee, while another 10 or so would be gassing up tractors or preparing combines. The first group would head to the fields, and the second wave would come to breakfast. They ate and went into the fields. By then, it was mid-morning, and the first breakfast eaters were ready for a snack. Coffee, cookies, cake, or pie. Then it was time for the next crew's coffee break. Then it was lunchtime, afternoon snack, supper. Sometimes after supper, the crews returned to the fields to work with lights on their combines and trucks. The next day, it started all over again. This was how they brought in the corn, soybeans, wheat, and sorghum. You would get the dishes done for one group, and another would come in ready to eat. The dozen or so women enjoyed the busy camaraderie. They would say things like, "They sure can put it away. It's good to see such healthy appetites."
Risa Willis reading from Farmer's Daughter, and I Can Prove It. And Risa, you mentioned earlier something about family secrets, and you dedicate a whole chapter of the book to exploring family secrets. But one of the things that you point out is when you were growing up, you really didn't know that much about your family history, and you didn't have access to that information either. Do you think that your parents really wanted to shield you from their family history for some reason?
I don't know, or if they just always, when I would ask questions, I would just get like, "Oh, well, that was in the past. We need to concentrate on the present." I just don't think they thought about it as much as Americans do now. And it always, you know, here we are in autumn time, harvesting time, Thanksgiving's coming up. And when I go out and talk to people about writing memoirs, I say, you know, ask some questions. If you don't ask, you know, the answer is no. So ask some questions. You know, bring out some photographs. Say, who was this person? How was he or she related to you? I think I might have found out more later if I'd had some grandparents to ask, mm-hmm. or if my parents had lived longer,
right.
or if my two sisters had lived longer. When you start to think about these things, often the people that can answer those questions are gone.
And you did have your hands on a family Bible at one time. Your aunt brought it over to your house. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, this is my Aunt Ethel, and she had the family Bible, and it was a huge thing. And you probably know, you or some of your listeners out there, know about these family Bibles. It was very thick, very ornate. And it was full of letters, and it looks like bits and pieces of diaries, maybe, and snippets of wedding dresses. And, you know, I was raised with the Cinderella idea that, you know, you had a white wedding dress. So when I started looking at these little swaths of cloth, they were like polka dots or stripes, and I thought, well, those are unusual wedding dresses. And I said, well, where's Mom's? And at that point, my mother came into the room, and she shut that Bible down and took it out of the room, and that's the last time I saw it, and I have no idea. Of course, I didn't think much about it afterwards.
Right, but, not for years.
You know, because that's what Mom wanted to do, okay. But now I really mourn the loss of that family Bible. And I don't know what happened to it, and I, from my aunt's family, doesn't know. So it's just one of those sad things. So if you know, here's my message: if you know of a family Bible, take good care of it.
Absolutely. Well, and you share the family stories that you remember in this book. Is that a way of preserving the history that you do have access to, even if it may not be 100% accurate, because these are childhood memories?
That's right. Yeah, this is the way I remember it. It's interesting. I've had some people contact me from where I went to high school, and they would say, well, that, because I changed names. You know,
right.
I changed the names to protect, as I said, the innocent, the guilty, and the indifferent. someone would say, well, that was so-and-so, wasn't it? And I'd say, do you think so? And they never did guess, or they couldn't see themselves in it, which I thought was just so interesting about the human psyche.
Well, and speaking of the human psyche, you had a couple real characters in your family. There was a moment when your Aunt Florence was concerned that the apocalypse was coming. Tell me how she responded.
Yeah. Well, she was a city woman, which is probably, according to my dad and my mother, that was the root of her problems could be. But she just kind of didn't fit in farming community. She was always way dressed up, too much for a farmer's wife, not going to church at that time. But at that point, there is all over the news, as we hear every once in a while now, the end is here. You know, the world's ending. At this particular time, all the planets were lined up, as I described, like a shish kebab. So it was going to happen. And her answer to all this was she packed her suitcase. I guess she wanted to be neat when she met Jesus. And she crawled up a tree.
To be closer?
I guess so. I don't know. And my uncle came and got my mother to come and talk her down, which she did.
And what, you were at a 4-H meeting at this moment?
I was at a 4-H meeting, and we were very nervous because we thought, you know, the end was coming. I think they even gave us a central time that it was going to happen. Well, it came and went. But it was spooky. Spooky for kids, and I guess spooky for adults that didn't have, you know, someplace to look these things up.
Absolutely. So when you went back for that high school reunion, again, after being away for so long, what did it feel like? How did it feel to reconnect with the people that you really had lost contact with?
Well, the thing that just hit me, first of all, was we never get out of high school.
It felt the same?
It seemed the same. Of course, personalities. And there was the planning group. There were the jocks. There were the funny ones. You know, of course, I'm in that crowd, too. I was the editor of the yearbook, so I hadn't changed a lot. You know, I'm still writing. So, yeah, we never really get out of high school.
You write about that night of the high school reunion when the music started to play, and of course it's the music from your high school years, and you had requested the Rolling Stones. You never got to hear a Rolling Stones song that night, but you've been a lifelong Rolling Stones fan, at least ever since you first heard them, and you have to tell us about the time you first heard them. That it's a remarkable story.
Yeah, this was the Stones were actually playing and recording in England in 1962, but it wasn't until 1964, when the Beatles were big, you know, came to the United States, that I think a lot of people saw potential of, let's make money, let's bring British bands over here. And they brought the Stones over, and they were touring the United States, and they were to play in Omaha. And I had a friend whose older sister had gone to work in Omaha at a TV station that had an afternoon kind of sock hop.
Right, like TV American show. Bandstand, but local,
yeah,
right?
A local thing, which was pretty common in those days. And it was one of her jobs as a secretary assistant to try to get people in to see the Rolling Stones, and no one knew who they were. And so she called upon her mother to bring as many friends she could to Omaha to see these people. And so, you know, I had to get permission to go because a trip to Omaha in those days was a really big deal. No four-lane highways, you know.
Right.
And it might have involved an overnight stay. And so, yes, the Rolling Stones played in Omaha, 1964. I believe it was in the springtime. Must have been. School might have just been out. And they toured the United States. That was their first visit to the United States. And whenever they come back, I go and see them.
Well, I love when you arrived at the television studio, your contact there looked at your group and said, "What? You could only bring four?"
Yeah.
And then she said, "It's okay. We'll move the bleachers. We'll move one of the sets of bleachers so it looks like a crowd." So yeah. She really couldn't drum up people to go see the Rolling Stones.
No. Yeah, no one knew who they were. I mean, here they are. They still tour. And there's, it's funny, you know, as many Rolling Stones as there are fans as there are in the world, you can go to a concert, and believe me, I've been all over the United States, my husband and I, and you'll see people that you know, that you've seen elsewhere.
Wow.
And there's always this little contest of, well, how many times have you seen them? Well, I've never actually counted that up, but when they get to me, I always say, since 1964.
And then
you
win.
And everybody gets real quiet.
So, now, when they played for this show, you guys had to be the incredibly enthusiastic fans, and they wanted, like, Beatlemania-type fandom,
yeah.
But you had never heard the Stones before, so how did they coach you to try to get that out of you?
They would point at us and get us, we had to practice screaming before they ever came on. We had to practice screaming, and they would point at us, and we had to scream. Well, I guess I wasn't screaming enthusiastically enough. I never saw the sense in it myself. If you like something, you can sway with the music or clap or something. I didn't see the purpose of screaming. But, yeah, they pointed at us, and we screamed, and, you know.
And you think that that even put the Stones on edge? You don't think they were used to that
yeah.
kind of shrieking?
Yeah, I don't think they quite understood the United States either, because the United States is a big place. As we know, but England's not very big. It's about the size of the state of Alabama. And so getting from one place in the United States to another is a lot more difficult, especially in those days, than in getting around Britain. That was one thing my husband had to learn when he moved here.
After they performed, there was a little more TV to do. You got to stick around and watch that as well. They got to help film a car commercial?
Well, it was, a local car dealership had, and I wish it was a sports car of some sort. It may have been a Corvette. I'm not sure what it was. But, the Stones were all around it, and you could tell that I named him Boogie Bob. I really did not remember the announcer's name or the host, but I named him Boogie Bob. I thought that worked. And you could tell he was getting really, really nervous. And after they cut from the commercial and the Stones were getting in and out of the car and everything, he said, "Please, somebody get me away from the Rolling Stones."
Well, and he also surreptitiously walked over to the car and removed the keys at some point.
He's out, yeah.
An incredible memory, the beginning of stardom there. So I'm curious, you've written a couple of biographies. You've taught, as an English professor over the years. Were you reluctant to write your own story?
Well, yeah, in a way. I'm glad I had some distance from it. And I really hadn't thought too much about it. You know, I write all the time. I write a lot of different things. But just two big things happened at once. One was getting an aerial photograph sent by a neighbor to me of the farm with my family's farm, and it's in the book with a picture of the outbuildings and everything, which now unfortunately are gone.
Mm-hmm.
And about the same time was this class reunion, and it really made me think that that farm life was a good start. It gave me a good start in life, with a lot of values and ideas that have served me well. And I think probably served my students well, too.
And you mentioned...
I hope readers.
Yeah, your parents passed away basically as you were leaving for college. Your father died of a heart attack. The year later, your mother died because of a brain tumor.
Yes.
And I'm sure that was an incredibly difficult and heartbreaking time for you. Did writing about this help you make peace with that in some way?
Yes, it did. It's, as I said, there's no one to ask now about these things. But it did make me think about them. and think about what I did know, what I did remember, and yeah, it made me happy that I grew up on a farm in Iowa.
Would you advise people to go to their class reunions?
I will leave that up to them.
Are you going to go to 45 or 50?
I think they're probably getting pretty ready to do the 50th. You know, it's sad that I get emails and from the organizers always, but they're usually emails of who's passed on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's sobering to think that your classmates, some of them are no longer with us, and it also makes of one's think of our own mortality. So perhaps.
You poked a little bit of fun at the organizers of the class reunion in the book, but they're still sending you emails, right?
Yes, they are.
Oh, good. Well, Risa Willis, it has been a delight to talk to you, and your stories are, it's just a wonderful read. Thank you so much.
Well, I have to say one last thing besides thank you. Go Hawkeyes.
All right. Risa Willis, she's the author of Farmer's Daughter and I Can Prove It. She's a professor emerita of English at Drury University in Springfield, Missouri, and she grew up on a farm near Little Sioux in western Iowa. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to spend some time remembering the life and work of Kurt Michael Fries, who passed away last Friday. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Kurt Michael Fries of Iowa City passed away suddenly last week at the age of 54. He was an extraordinary man who, by all accounts, felt that he could and should make a difference by working hard for what he believed in. He was a frequent guest on this program because he was constantly involved in new projects. Local food was one of his main passions. With his wife, Kim McWayne Fries, he opened the restaurant Devotee in 1996 in Iowa City. The restaurant was named for the couple's children, Devin and Taylor, and it was one of the first farm-to-table restaurants in Iowa. He was the author of A Cook's Journey, Slow Food in the Heartland, the co-author of Chasing Chili's, Hot Spots Along the Pepper Trail. He was the publisher of Edible Iowa River Valley. He was the founding leader of Slow Food Iowa City. He served on the Slow Food USA National Board of Directors, and his columns on and photos on food, wine, and travel have appeared in local, regional, and national newspapers and magazines. In 2016, he decided to run for the Johnson County Board of Supervisors on a platform of preserving farmland in the North Corridor from residential development and removing barriers to local food production. And in addition to his work in Iowa City and Johnson County, he also served as director of local food and advocacy at Nubo City Market in Cedar Rapids. He was also active in the political campaigns of others, an activist for causes he believed in, and of course, a beloved husband, father, and friend. And I'm sure there were many things that he did that I haven't mentioned. For the next few minutes, we're going to look back on his life and talk about his legacy, and you are welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me is Michelle Kenyon, Director of Field to Family, an organization working for more local, healthy, and sustainable regional food system. Michelle, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
And I know that your work is in the local food movement, and you really considered Kurt to be a mentor. Can you tell me a little bit about when you first connected with him?
Yes, I first connected with Kurt when I first started working for Field to Family in 2009. We were considering starting a farm-to-school chapter, and I had known he had a past in local foods that went way beyond my time. And, you know, farm to school connects farmers to the schools, increases school gardens, and increases the amount of local foods in the cafeteria. He was able to provide some history of his own efforts working with the food service staff in our school district.
Which was extensive.
Actually, it was. He was ahead of his time. The support just wasn't quite there yet. But it didn't stop him from knocking on the door several times and bringing in chefs to the school cafeterias, showing the staff how to make simple and create simple recipes with local foods.
When you first met him, I would love to hear your impression. I mean, I just read a partial list of all of the things that he was involved with. When you first met him, what did you know about him as far as his impact on local food? Because he was really at the forefront of that movement here in Iowa, but also around the country.
Right, absolutely. He was well known for creating a restaurant based on the growing season, based on relationships with farmers, close relationships with farmers. You would walk into Devotee and see a list of numerous farmers that just went on and on, and all the ingredients they were sourcing for their menu. His commitment to using local food was strong. And of course, it was new at the time. There weren't many restaurants in the state even that were sourcing as much local as Devotee. He also was known as a writer and loved to read about food, study about food. I mean, his love for local food went beyond just experiencing it and cooking it. He wanted to know more about it. And he had already brought numerous national renowned food writers into Iowa City.
Well, and speaking of renowned food writers, I have one of those on the line as well. Alyssa Altman is the author of Poor Man's Feast, also has been a guest on this program. And I never probably would have known about her, except that Kurt sent me an email and said, you have to read this woman's book. She's coming to Iowa and you have to interview her. She's incredible. Alyssa is with us on the line as well. Hello, Alyssa.
Hello, Charity. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. And give us a little bit of your perspective, and we'll talk personally in a little while, but help us understand Kurt's place in the slow food or the local food movement nationally.
Well, Kurt, you know, Kurt, I think, you know, to back up just a little bit, Kurt was probably one of the most kind, fair, and ethical people, writers, food people, chef, small business owner, so on and so forth, I've ever known. And the core of Slow Food, both Slow Food USA, which is a national, you know, national program, but also an international program. I think it's in something like 160 countries, and there are, you know, thousands and thousands of members. The core values of Slow Food are, you know, good, clean, and fair, and, you know, that good nutrition is a right for everyone at, you know, everywhere. That ecosystems and society should be diverse, that community and place should be joyful, and we should all be able to sit down at the table with each other, both, you know, metaphorically and literally, that, you know, our natural resources need to be protected, food needs to be promoted that is local and seasonable and sustainably grown, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, this was an organization that was founded originally in Italy by a man named Carlo Petrini, you know, some years ago. Alice Waters of Chez Panisse, who Kurt knew well, was very involved in it. And so I think it was a natural fit for him, both as a food professional, as a small business owner, and just as a person, because he embodied all of those values. If you removed him from the food community, which is an unthinkable thing, but if you removed him from the food community, he would still embody all of those values. And so when he was involved with Slow Food in Iowa, it just seemed to be, you know, it seemed to be the perfect fit. I mean, here is this beautiful state with this, you know, enormous agricultural resources and with a tremendous agricultural history. And it was his goal and his, he felt, I think his duty to maintain all of the old, you know, what we call in the food world, food ways. And I think he did that, and that was what drove him and what motivated him.
Alyssa, I have so many more questions for you, but I also want to give other people an opportunity to share their memories as well. And the phone lines are full. David is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, David.
Hi, Charity.
Hi, what would you like to say about Kurt?
Well, I wanted to just share a couple of, you know, really specific anecdotes. You know, we've been talking a lot of the big picture stuff, but, you know, I'm a chef and I'm a local food activist too. This is probably 20 years ago, we were working together to start Field to Family, actually, who Michelle's the director of. And, it's just a very specific thing. You know, we were taking a vote about something. The vote did not go Kurt's way, but he was completely unflustered and completely democratic about it. He accepted it and just, you know, carried on with the mission. It was really quite impressive, you know.
Yeah. For a man with such strong vision and such strong opinions, he was good at listening and being conciliatory?
Well, just that he really believed in the democratic process, I think. You know, that's, yeah, exactly. The vision was, or the movement was more important than anything else, I think. And you know, one other kind of sadly poignant anecdote, we were, again, 20 years ago chatting at the beginning of this, you know, when local food was really just starting to be a buzzword. And, you know, we sat there and realized that the work of the movement would be still going on after we were gone. And so it's a great shock that has come much sooner than any of us expected.
Yeah.
But I think to just, you know, the best honoring of his memory would be to stay active and keep working on this movement.
Yeah. Well, and it is remarkable to think about how far it has come in the years that you have been working on it and Kurt has been working on it. David Burt, thank you so much for calling.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Matt is also on the line in Mount Vernon. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you, Charity?
I'm good. Matt Steigerwald, I assume, from Mount Vernon.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. What would you like to share?
Well, you know, we moved here in 2000, and I had never been to Iowa before. I'm from the East Coast. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I was looking for someone to work with when I first moved here. I had no intention of opening the Lincoln Cafe, but I didn't know anybody, and found him when I came here because everybody said that if I was interested in doing local foods, you know, that he would be the person to work with. And he gave me a job right away, right when I got here, and I worked for him for about 6 months while I figured out opening the restaurant in Mount Vernon. And it was a real lifeline for me because I literally knew no one here except my wife. And to have someone who had the same values as I did was so helpful because there was, at the time, you know, in Iowa at the time, there was not a whole lot of that. And it was just a real comfort, and I'll never forget that. And he was just so helpful to me getting the restaurant open, knowing the farmers to call. There were not many at the time. There's plenty now. You know, I'll just always be thankful for that. It was just really, really helpful.
Right. Well, and you talk about not knowing anyone. Kurt knew everyone.
Yeah, indeed, he did. He was the right person to get a hold of when I came out here, for sure.
Well, Matt Steigerwald, thank you for calling.
Sure. Thank you.
Mike Carberry is on the line next. Johnson County supervisor, of course, served with Kurt as a supervisor. Hello, Mike.
Yes, good morning, Charity. Yeah. Thanks for having this program about Kurt. Kurt's been a dear friend, for probably one of my best friends for the last 15 years. And you're right, he helped so many people get elected. He helped me get elected, and he was considering running for office when I did, and he said, well, Mike, since we share the same values and we're going to run on the same issues like urban sprawl, local foods, et cetera, he says, I'm going to help you get elected, and then in 2 years I'll run and you help me get elected, and that's exactly what happened. I'd just like to talk a little bit about Kurt's love of the land, the soil. Kurt was so much into protecting natural areas and farmland from urban sprawl, you know, from what he called lily pad development. And he had a saying that I'll always remember him for and I will always use. He says, we need to stop pouring concrete on good farmland. And, you know, not only did Kurt support local foods, but he also supported, you know, traditional agriculture if it was done sustainably. And, you know, he fought for clean water. He fought for against animal confinements and some of the things that are, you know, polluting our environment if they're not done sustainably. So Kurt, you know, so many issues that he ran on, that he worked so hard on. He just had the biggest heart. He was always working on issues of equity and making sure to lift people up who didn't have a voice.
Well, Mike Carberry, thank you for sharing your remembrance.
You're welcome, Journey.
And we have just a couple of minutes left, and so many people who have shared remembrances online and so many words that I wish that I had time to share. But Alyssa, I want to ask you before we run out of time, Kurt brought you to Iowa, and it's very clear that, I mean, Kurt had standing on the national scene, even internationally with the slow food movement, but he was so committed to working here in Iowa. And you're in Connecticut. Can you give us, from your sort of outsider's perspective, why do you think Kurt loved Iowa so much? What was his commitment?
I think that he could see, and I say this as a, you know, as a New Englander, but I think having spent time, significant amount of time in Iowa with Kurt and his community and his family, is that I think that he was an eternal optimist, and he could see in his community and in his neighbors and in the world around him, possibility and the fact that I think that he believed that if he elevated people, even people on the other side of the political fence with vastly different beliefs, that he would bring out the best in everyone around him, and he did that. And for you know, some places I think are ripe for that sort of thing, and some places are much more divided. And I think that he felt, as I think we all feel, that Iowa is very much a place where people want to come together. And he brought as many people together as he possibly could, and he did it with love and a sense of integrity and fairness. And, you know, it's just unthinkable that he's not here. But we're going to have to keep doing this in his name.
Alyssa Altman, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity.
Alyssa Altman, author of Poor Man's Feast, and Michelle Kenyon, we have just about 1 minute left. What are your thoughts as you move forward? I mean, Kurt is gone, but so much of his work continues. There are so many people now committed to the local food movement in Iowa. What do you think his legacy is?
His legacy has been defined. He was a very forward, innovative thinker when it comes to community food systems, when it comes to building a community where people are welcomed and supported. A lot of the efforts that he's been involved in with the Johnson County Board of Supervisors are really just getting started. He's planted a lot of seeds. Many have germinated. Many have rooted. He fought for funding for a food hub for Johnson County, and that's just getting started. He supported farm stands that provided access to more people for local foods. A plan, a comprehensive plan for the historic poor farm that Johnson County owns and manages that includes a farm incubator and so many other exciting projects. His work will continue.
Well, Michelle Kenyon, thank you, and I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Michelle Kenyon, Director of Field to Family. We've been remembering Kurt Michael Fries, who passed away last Friday. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.